Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sam's, saluting its client, Walt Disney World, for its $28 million of philanthropic support each year for children and families in Central Florida. I'm Gary Hunter of Hopping Green and Sam's.
The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The U.S. Supreme Court may have upheld requirements that everyone purchase health insurance or pay a fine, but that doesn't mean that all Americans will be insured.
There are going to be people who make too much money for Medicaid, too young for Medicare, are not employed in jobs where the employer provides insurance.
Governor Scott says Florida won't implement optional parts of the federal health care law, but others say that's not for him to decide.
Quite frankly, it's not up to the governor, and to that extent, we're glad to see the leaders in the House indicating that they're going to actually take a look at the implementation.
Florida's election law sees a new challenge this week. An environmentalist warned one of Florida's most popular springs is in danger of being dried up in less than 2 years. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. While the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the federal health care law, the fight over it is far from over. Many questions about President Barack Obama's signature legislation remain, like who will be covered under the Affordable Care Act, who will have to buy insurance, and will it bring down costs? Lynn Hatter reports the results may be just as complex as the law itself.
On the day the U.S. Supreme Court announced its ruling upholding the federal health care law, a woman named Patricia is standing outside Florida's Capitol building. She's on a tour with a 4-H group.
I have not investigated it myself, to be honest. My husband, I have to say, is more into that kind of stuff, and he gives me an overview.
Gotcha. And while she admits she doesn't know much about the specifics of the law, she is aware of its main requirement, that people purchase health insurance or pay a fine.
You know, those that don't have insurance are really probably thinking that's a really special thing. I've been fortunate. I've always had insurance. So I don't know. But yeah, I would say that there's a lot of benefits for those people that are needing it. Mm-hmm. And who knows? That might be me tomorrow, you know?
There are more than 300 million people living in the United States, and according to the federal government, 16% of them are uninsured. The federal health care law attempts to address that by requiring most people to carry insurance or pay a fine or a tax. But there are many questions about who will be providing that insurance. Will it be the federal government, private companies, small businesses? The answer is all of the above, and that's where things get tricky.
The hope was to greatly expand insurance, but it was never realistically suggested that it was going to cover everybody.
Dr. Marshall Kapp is a professor at the Florida State University College of Medicine. Under the federal health care law, programs like Medicaid, which provide supports to states to ensure low-income people, will be expanded. For those who make too much money to qualify for Medicaid but aren't covered by their employer, there will be state-run online marketplaces called insurance exchanges where they can buy federally subsidized plans. Some adults are now allowed to stay on their parents' insurance plans longer, but even with more people being covered, Kapp says many others will still be without health insurance.
Even with the various subsidies, there are going to be people who make too much money for Medicaid, too young for Medicare, are not employed in jobs where the employer provides insurance, and who simply can't afford to participate.
The federal health care law seeks to entice businesses to cover more people. One way it's doing that is by offering tax credits to those that insure their employees.
I was really excited last year when it turns out, because I'm a small business owner, that the tax credit I got was on my personal income tax. So that was really exciting news.
Wendy Halleck owns Tallahassee's Quarter Moon Import Store. She has a small staff of employees and insures one of them. While she has been able to tap into the tax credit program, under the law, she's not obligated to provide that health insurance. And that's because businesses with fewer than 50 employees are exempt from the law's penalty tax and are eligible for the credits if they choose to cover their workers. But the larger the business, the less those tax credits will cover. And FSU's Dr. Capps says for some employers, it may make more financial sense to actually drop employees from their plans.
Many employers may find it much cheaper economically to simply pay the penalty that employers of 50 or more are going to have to pay if they don't provide insurance that is supposed to be handled by the exchange system.
But if those people turn to the exchanges, they could end up paying more out-of-pocket costs. Capps says even when the health care law is fully in effect, millions of Americans will still be without insurance. Access to services due to a lack of providers will remain a problem, and costs may still rise. But he also admits he could be wrong about the whole thing.
Anybody who predicts what's going to happen is just speculating today. Within a few years, we will have some answers about the accuracy of the various speculations, because for better or worse, we're entering an experiment in which we are all unwilling human subjects.
The law's opponents are pushing to get it repealed, and the House is scheduled to vote on the matter. Congress could also enact legislation attempting to withhold funding from parts of the law, in effect, starving it. And in November, there will be a presidential election, which may determine whether the law stays or goes. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Florida has until 2014 to implement some of the provisions in the Affordable Care Act. Governor Rick Scott says the state won't do it. But Regan McCarthy reports some Florida lawmakers say it's too early to start jumping to conclusions.
The Florida Supreme Court upheld most of the federal Affordable Care Act, also called the Health Care Overhaul Law, but it left a few pieces up to the state. And Florida Governor Rick Scott says he's not implementing anything he can avoid.
It's very disappointing what the Supreme Court did. This is going to be devastating for patients.
Scott made the rounds on a number of national news stations this week, saying the state won't create insurance exchanges, which are meant to help citizens find health insurance coverage and compare prices. He told Fox News Florida won't expand its Medicaid rolls to cover more uninsured Floridians, even though the federal government would cover most of the cost, with the state paying nothing for the first 3 years and then slowly phasing up to cover about 10%. Scott says it just costs too much.
It's not free. I mean, it's $1.9 billion a year.
Right.
You're still paying it. I mean, the Florida taxpayers are paying federal taxes. On top of that, they're only going to cover all of it in the first 3 years.
But some are raising questions about Scott's message. First, there's the question about how much the Medicaid expansion would really cost the state. Scott says about $1.9 billion, but that number includes some state and federal spending and wraps up some non-Medicaid-related costs. Senate President-designate Don Gates says the Florida Senate's Health and Human Services Appropriation Committee staff's getting a number that's closer to $3.8 billion. And the Agency for Healthcare Administration says the expansion would cost somewhere between $1 and $1.4 billion. Other estimates put the number in the hundred millions. Gates says it's not surprising there are so many different cost estimates, but he says no matter what, it comes at a significant cost to the state.
No matter what number you use, the consequence is irrefutable, and that is it puts additional financial pressure on the people of Florida.
And some, like Representative Perry Thurston, the incoming leader of the Democratic caucus in the House and a supporter of the federal law, say the decision about whether to implement really isn't all up to the governor. Thurston says the governor can set the tone, but at the end of the day, lawmakers will make the decision.
Quite frankly, it's not up to the governor. And to that extent, we're glad to see the leaders in the House, Representative Weatherford at least, indicating that they're going to actually take a look at the implementation aspect of the Medicaid expansion.
Thurston says he feels strongly that implementing all parts of the Affordable Care Act is the best move for the state. He says Florida will continue to have people who need health care and can't pay for it themselves. So he says why not take advantage of the assistance the state is offering? He thinks it could save the state money.
The need will be there. The state will continue to pick it up without this assistance. It will just be done at a higher cost through emergency room care, which is vastly more expensive.
Incoming Senate President Gates says he's agreed with incoming House Speaker Will Weatherford to study the issue before settling on a decision about whether to implement optional parts of the law.
Speaker Weatherford and I have our respective professional staffs and attorneys tweezering through the opinion to determine what Florida's options and obligations are, and all of that is not entirely clear yet, but my guess is it will be, and we'll join with the governor in adopting a policy for Florida going forward, but give us time to read the opinion and understand it before we make a determination as to exactly what our options and obligations are.
Gates says he's not a fan of the act and feels the best thing would be for the measure to be repealed, but he also says he wants to ensure that no matter what happens, Florida is prepared. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, this week brought yet another challenge to Florida's election law.
That violates a portion of state law known as the Uniformity Statute, which requires uniform elections throughout the state.
We hear of efforts to put a stop to fraudulent insurance adjusters.
You see these same types of business models or same types of things that really drive up costs.
And environmentalists are sounding the alarm about Ocala's Silver Springs. They predict it will be all dried up if water managers don't take corrective action.
So the clock is ticking for Silver Springs. We are about to lose it.
Florida is once again faced with a legal challenge over its elections process. The American Civil Liberties Union and other groups are calling for an end to what they see as the state's dual system of elections. Out of Florida's 67 counties, five of them have to get pre-cleared by the federal government before any change can be implemented. That's due to a history of language and racial discrimination. But Baylor Johnson, a spokesman for the ACLU of Florida, says having five counties follow their own elections rules creates a two-tiered system.
What you have is two different sets of laws dictating elections in the state of Florida. That sets the stage for all sorts of potential problems.
Last year, the Florida legislature passed a new election law that curtailed early voting hours and made it harder for people to change their address on election day. The changes have not yet taken effect in those five counties because it is still under federal review. But this two-tiered system has already survived the presidential preference primary back in January.
Why is it now that this is being noticed?
It's not just that it's now being noticed. I'm trying to find 30-second answers for these questions, and it's hard.
Johnson eventually said when state officials realized they were about to lose a Justice Department review for violating the Voting Rights Act, they decided to push ahead with the new law in 62 counties and skip the ones under more intense scrutiny.
Now, that violates a portion of state law known as the Uniformity Statute, which requires uniform elections throughout the state.
But Chris Kate, a spokesman for the Florida Department of State, says they are waiting for the federal government to clear the five counties so they can adopt the law, followed by all the rest.
If the five counties are denied a preclearance approval, then the new law would not go into effect in those five counties. But that denial of preclearance does not directly impact the rest of the state because they are already implementing the new law.
So does that mean we will be stuck with the two-tiered system, of which would be in violation of current state law?
I would think that there would certainly... what's the best way to answer that?
Kate eventually said the department is confident that the new elections law is not discriminatory and will be approved. They're hoping to get a ruling soon so the process doesn't drag on. In the meantime, the ACLU, along with Democratic Tampa Senator Arthenia Joyner and the National Council of La Raza, are just taking the latest jab in the ongoing battle over Florida's elections by asking an administrative judge to order officials to use one set of rules for the entire state. The Florida Supreme Court has struck down a 2008 state law that limits the ability of public insurance adjusters to contact property owners within 48 hours of a disaster. Lawmakers say the measure was intended to protect citizens. But Ronald J. Eben reports the justices say the rule violates the free speech rights of those insurance adjusters.
After a disaster like Tropical Storm Debbie, many people become overwhelmed, wondering how to survive, how to clean up and get back to normal. Harvey Wolfman is the president of the Florida Association of Public Insurance Adjusters. He says he and his colleagues help Floridians who are in the midst of a crisis.
There's a lot of things that the adjuster does. In a fire, we take care of the inventory. When a policyholder is distraught and has no idea what to do, we take care of everything.
Public insurance adjusters help property owners to file and settle insurance claims, but insurance consumer advocate Robin Westcott says lawmakers had passed the measure 4 years ago in an attempt to help protect citizens who might be especially vulnerable right after a disaster.
Many times you have an immediate crisis in your home, like a water, some sort of water damage, and it's very stressful. It's an immediate problem, and someone approaches you with an assignment, and it could be any type of immediate claim like this, but an assignment of benefits. Just sign this paper, and I'll take care of, all the claims, all the filing of the claim with your insurance company.
Westcott says that sets consumers up to be taken advantage of by a person who might not be licensed to help them file a claim. And she says that fraud or unscrupulous behavior can drive up insurance cost.
You see these same types of business models or same types of things that really drive up cost. And really, it's the consumer who ends up paying for all these things. And generally, they don't necessarily, I think, understand sometimes when they are approached by these individuals that they really are harming their communities. They're harming they're ultimately causing rates to go up in our state by being complacent or maybe even just, not being aware that they can be exploited in this manner.
The justices rule the law is unconstitutional because it infringes on the commercial speech rights of public insurance adjusters. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ronald J. Eben.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Three Florida Supreme Court justices have been cleared of illegally using state employees for campaign activities. Representative Scott Plakin, a Longwood Republican, wrote a letter to Governor Scott alleging that Justices Barbara Pariente, R. Fred Lewis, and Peggy Quince violated the law by using court employees to notarize paperwork to qualify for this year's ballot. Governor Scott forwarded the letter to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which concluded their investigation, saying there was no wrongdoing. And Florida State University law professor Sandy Dallenberg says he agrees.
Here what you've got is just a fairly simple clerical task being performed by someone, and clearly it's not a task that carries with it any advocacy or endorsement. It's just simply performing a simple task of handling papers that really does not advance the campaign in any way at all.
State Attorney Willie Meigs announced Thursday there was no reason to continue the investigation. However, Governor Rick Scott is now looking to a lawsuit in the Leon County Court by an out-of-state legal group called Southeastern Legal Foundation. They're hoping to disqualify the justices. If that happens, Scott could replace the justices with his own picks if they fail to win retention or are removed from the ballot. Dallenberg says he would not have thought twice about using clerical help to notarize documents if he was one of the justices.
People who are behind these campaigns really don't have much respect for the judicial system or for our proper balanced separation of powers.
Dallenberg says the investigation was over a trivial matter. Supporters of the justices argue it's normal practice for state employees to notarize candidate papers. And in other news, the neighborhood watch volunteer who killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin has left a Central Florida jail less than 24 hours after a judge set his bond at $1 million. George Zimmerman left the Seminole County Jail earlier today. He was wearing a white dress shirt and a jacket. Mark Simpson from member station WMFE in Orlando brings us this update.
Zimmerman was quickly escorted into a waiting SUV after being released from jail. He will be monitored using a GPS tracking device, and his movements are restricted to Seminole County. Attorney Don West says the legal team will likely ask for Zimmerman's movement restrictions to be lifted because he is still receiving threats against him.
Well, we take them seriously. We can't evaluate them. Certainly, if it's an online threat, for example, how does one evaluate whether that's imminent or whether it's just someone venting?
Zimmerman faces second-degree murder charges in the death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Earlier this week, the judge overseeing the case scolded Zimmerman, saying it appeared he was trying to manipulate the legal system. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Mark Simpson in Orlando.
Finally, Silver Springs has been attracting swimmers, kayakers, nature enthusiasts, and other tourists since the mid-1800s. And back in the 1950s, it drew 800,000 visitors a year.
Surrounded by the beauty of Florida's Silver Springs on Highway 40 in the center of the Sunshine State, it's formed by countless freshwater springs that bubble from a sandy bottom.
But as Jessica Palumbo reports, one of Florida's most popular natural attractions will disappear soon if people don't change their habits.
Some predictions show the springs drying up completely in less than 2 years. And Charles Lee, outreach director for Audubon Florida, says he knows why.
And you see an upwelling of water that looks sort of like a churning mound of water in the center of the spring. Well, that hasn't been there for better than 10 years now. I mean, you look at the spring and it's just a glassy, flat surface of water because of the significantly reduced amount of flow out of Silver Springs.
Dr. Robert Knight, who directs the nonprofit Florida Springs Institute, has been documenting that significantly reduced flow. Knight's data show the spring has lost roughly two-thirds of its flow since the 1980s. Lee says, judging by the rate of decline in flow just over the past year,
in the future, the spring would run out of water and go dry in 20 months. If you take the rate of decline, which is more conservative over the last 12 years, and multiply that out into the future, the spring would go dry in another 12 years. So the clock is ticking for Silver Springs. We are about to lose it.
People who haven't visited Silver Springs might recognize the area from its many appearances on TV and movie screens. It was the filming location for classics like the original Tarzan films and The Creature from the Black Lagoon. Today, the state of Florida owns the land the springs are on and leases it to an entertainment company that runs a multi-million-dollar theme park and the always popular glass-bottom boat tours. Lee says the spring and all of the tourism dollars are in danger of drying up because of two things: a long-term decrease in rainfall across the state and increased groundwater pumping for human use.
A spring will flow as long as there is water in the aquifer at a higher level above the orifice of the spring that pushes the water out.
So when a businessman recently applied for a permit to pump millions of gallons of water per day for a nearby cattle ranch, environmentalists rallied against the proposal. Supporters of the cattle operation have touted it as a job creator for North Central Florida. But former U.S. Senator and former Governor Bob Graham, who leads the Florida Conservation Coalition, disagrees.
I think it's exactly the opposite, that the whole economy of Florida today and in the future is going to depend upon our wise use of water, and that if we allow some of our major sources to be destroyed, those will be defeats from which we can never recover.
In May, Dr. Knight of the Springs Institute sent his alarming findings about Silver Springs in a letter to the directors of the two adjacent water management districts and to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. He urged immediate action, including an all-out moratorium on granting large-scale water pumping permits. The St. Johns River Water Management District is reviewing the cattle ranch permit application, and district spokesman Hank Largen says Knight's letter definitely raised some eyebrows.
Dr. Knight made some very good points in his letter, and he had some suggestions that we wanted to follow up on.
So the directors of the St. Johns River and Southwest Florida Water Management Districts and DEP leaders met with Knight to discuss the situation. Next, they're going to meet and share their own data about Silver Springs with each other.
You know, we wanted to get all the science on the same page.
Largen says they'll also be inviting public input on the issue at future meetings. But for the time being, the districts do not plan moratoria on water use permits. He says they evaluate each pumping application according to standards set by the Florida legislature. But Charles Lee of Audubon, Florida, says those standards don't reflect new rainfall levels.
So when they run the models that determine how much can be, quote, safely, close quote, withdrawn from the aquifer, they're running those models on the basis of outdated information that says we're getting a lot more rain than we really are.
Jim Stevenson, a retired senior biologist with the Department of Environmental Protection, says governments aren't the only ones who affect spring levels and quality. He says springs all over Florida are not crystal clear anymore because of residents' everyday actions.
Stop fertilizing. It's amazing how much fertilizer we use on our lawns. It is totally unnecessary and ends up going down to the groundwater as a nitrate and out to our springs where it creates serious problems with algae and hydrilla.
Audubon's Charles Lee says at Silver Springs, the algae is so bad their namesake silver sand is now army green. But if water regulators don't change their use permit guidelines soon, he fears there won't be any spring left to clean up. The St. Johns River and Southwest Florida Water Management Districts and DEP leaders are meeting on July 19th to discuss the issue. And the Cattle Ranch water permit application is still being reviewed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Trimmel Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org.
Capitol Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sam's, saluting its client Walt Disney World for its $28 million of philanthropic support each year for children and families in Central Florida. I'm Gary Hunter of Hopping Green and Sam's.
The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. And the Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.